Well, good evening, everybody. I think it's about time that we started our evening session. And my name is Fergus MacDonald. I'm the chairman of the Scottish Evangelical Theology Society. And I give those of you who are with us for this evening only a very warm welcome. We're very glad to have you with us, and we hope that you will feel very much part of us. And I hope that some of you may be inspired to join SETS, the Scottish Evangelical Theology Society. Lawrence Osborne is our membership secretary, and he'll be very happy to explain what is involved afterwards. Could you stand up for a moment, Lawrence, please? So, you know, you want to come, there had been a request you come to the front to be seen, Lawrence. There's empty seats around here at the front. Yeah, Lawrence, thank you very much. You've now been exposed. Each year, the Scottish Evangelical Theology Society have an annual public lecture, which we call the Finlayson Lecture, after Roderick Finlayson, who was the first chairman of SETS when it was founded, I can't remember, years, 30-odd years ago. And there's some of us who were around then, not very many, some ancient people like Andrew McGowan and myself, but for most of us it is history. He was a great enthusiast for this event, and to bring together not simply people who are, you know, technically theologians who are working in academia, but also pastors and representatives of the churches, because theology is for everybody, not just for those who got REV in front of their names. So we honour him, and there's two seats over here in the front row. Want to say that there have been some significant changes within ICC, the International Christian College, in the last few days, in that they're changing and going to move from here. And there is an official statement of this which is available. And I think it's important that we all see, if we're interested in ICC, that we see this, because this is the official text. And sometimes when changes like that take place, rumors get around. And it's important to know that ICC is, in fact, leaving here but moving elsewhere and continuing its ministry. It's a very important ministry in the city. So these, Jane, where are they? People were giving them as they came in. That's fine. Excellent. Thank you very much indeed. We have a bookstall. And I'm going to ask Alex, who is our bookstall manager, salesperson, enthusiast for books, to come and give us a few brief book reviews. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Good evening. It's great to be with you this evening. My name's Alex. I work for a Christian book company called Ten of Those. And what we love doing is going around the country to events like this, to churches, to Bible colleges, to anyone who'll have us, to try and get really good quality Christian resources into people's hands. So that might be to resource people for academic study, for their churches, for their personal lives, for their outreach, whatever it is. If there's good Christian literature out there to help them, we just want to get it to them as cheaply as we can and make it available so that people can be using it. I'm just going to recommend a few things that are on the bookstall for you tonight. First of all, I need to mention a book called The Good God by Mike Reeves, who's our speaker tonight. If you've ever heard Mike speak, he's very passionate. I love listening to him, and he writes in exactly the same way. I really enjoyed reading this book. It's really encouraging and heartwarming just to see how good God is. I would highly recommend that. I'd say that's the best book I read last year. We've got a couple of special offers on, so we've got John Lennox DVDs and books on a 3-for-2 offer, including The God Delusion Debate and a whole load of others, and another offer on C.S. Lewis books. I think they're £5 each or £3 for £9. It's an absolute bargain. That includes the Screwtape Letters and a couple of others. If you're just after some, maybe you're not really into Christian reading. A lot of people aren't. They've never really got into picking up Christian books. Don't see the point. It can be so helpful just to find something easy, a really easy way in, and just be really encouraged by that. A couple of things I would recommend. First of all, we've got our own set of devotions, which are undated. They're a great way just to get into the Bible each morning, or if you miss a morning because they're undated, you don't have to feel too guilty. If you're like me, that's a good thing. These are really helpful. They just give you 5 to 10 minutes looking through a passage, a bit of explanation, and then some things to reflect on and pray about. So do have a look at those there. £2 each or three for £5, so you can't go too wrong with that. We've also got a series of just really short books, for people who aren't really into reading. So things like The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness by Tim Keller. It barely weighs anything, it's that small. You could probably read it in under an hour. It's only £1. This is a great book. I read it with a bunch of students when I was working in a church before we went on a mission trip, and they found it really encouraging just to think how they can kind of let go of themselves, go out and be thinking about other people instead of just trying to preserve ourselves and worry about how we look. One other book to mention, you might have seen there's a whole series of Puritan paperbacks come out recently, being sort of redesigned. One called The Heart of Christ by Thomas Goodwin, which looks at just how much Christ loves us. I know Mike would recommend that because he wrote the foreword in it, and it's got his words on the back. It's great just to think about how good God is, how much he loves us, and be encouraged by that, because, you know, we can talk about things like mission and outreach and how our churches should look, but if it's not focused on who God is, then we're kind of missing the point. So it's great just to enjoy him and know his love for us. There's all those books on the bookstore, so many others. If there's something you want that's not there, do come and speak to me, see if we can get it for you. I just want to serve you and help you get the things that will resource you and be helpful to you. So maybe see you afterwards at the bookstore. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Alex. You notice that he strategically situated the bookstore. Well, you can't get out of the building without passing the bookstore. That's a good strategy. Well, it's now my happy privilege and pleasure to introduce our special lecturer tonight in the person of the Reverend Mike Reeves. Mike comes to us as the head of theology in UCCF, and he has fulfilled and is fulfilling a very important ministry there. Prior to that, he was an associate minister in All Souls Church, is that correct, in London, which is known by all of us, at least by reputation, and we're delighted to have you. In addition, he's written this excellent book, which has just been mentioned by Alex, and could I sort of add my amen to what Alex said? We've been looking at that book in our small reading group. We have a set reading group in Edinburgh, and we've gone through the book this last few weeks, and we found it very, very helpful and very challenging. So I would certainly commend that to you. A lot of people think that the doctrine of the Trinity is very speculative and non-practical. Well, if you think that, read the book and you'll get a big surprise. And I'm sure you'll get a surprise tonight too, because that is the theme, at least the Trinity is the theme. In particular, the Trinity, the secret to joyful Christianity. So with much pleasure, Mike, I invite you now to come forward and speak to us. Thank you.
Evening, everyone. Well, I got here in just the nick of time. My flight was rearranged, and it arrived at about 6:15. So Angus was there waiting at the airport, engine revving. My title I've been given is The Trinity, Secret to Joyful Christianity. And particularly if you're hopping into the conference as a guest just for this evening, you especially might be thinking, yeah, right. The Trinity, Secret to Joyful Christianity. Because I think it's so easy for us as Christians to think, okay, there's the God that we know and love, but then, here's what these couple of days are all about. Then over there, somewhere in some hidden cloisters, are these beings called theologians. They're pasty-faced and socially disastrous. And they like looking at this thing called the Trinity. It's the sort of thing that keeps them entertained while we live life. It's this sort of irrelevant mathematical gibberish, abandon fun, all ye who enter here. And it's quite deep within the Christian psyche today that the Trinity, whilst it's kind of it's written into our faith, is quite deep in us that it's not there to be celebrated. That the Trinity is an awkward, rather odd irrelevance. It's a wart on our knowledge of God. Shave it off if you could. And so when it comes to sharing our faith, I certainly notice this in the church's mission. I see Christians wanting to speak about God's offer of salvation, wanting to speak about God's offer of free grace, but really it seems trying very hard not to mention which God they're talking about. Not to be clear that the God they're talking about is a triune God, especially if you're talking with a Muslim. Just back way off on Trinity talk seems to be a fairly default position, which means we're waxing lyrical about the beauty of the gospel, but not so much about the beauty of the God whose gospel it is. What I want to try to suggest tonight is that no, before all things, before all the beautiful things of the gospel, before salvation by grace, before the cross, before the resurrection, logically before all those things, it is who God is as Trinity that makes Christianity good. All the good things in the gospel flow from who God is as triune, being Father, Son, and Spirit. That I'd like to suggest without the Trinity, we would have no good news. The cross would not be good news if God were different, if God were not triune. The resurrection would not be good news for us. There would be no salvation by grace alone if God were not triune. By the way, that's just a sneaky call for everyone here to become a theologian, really. Whatever it is you're going to be doing with your life, knowing who God is a pressing into the ultimate good that liberates, that frees us. That's what we're going to be doing now. Now, why is the Trinity the secret to joyful Christianity? Why? Why is this God so liberating? Okay, here's the thing. I certainly don't naturally warm to the thought of God. Why should you? The thought of God, just within the concept, God, is not especially attractive. Just supremacy, the creator, there's nothing inherently attractive about such a title. And so I think where we start from in default in our thinking about God is we think, okay, God may be able to provide me with stuff like heaven, and that would be nice, but I'm not interested in God in himself straight away. I'm interested in what he can provide. I'm interested in what he wants so that I don't anger him, so that I may please him, perhaps, but it's really so that I can get what I want from him. I'm not interested in God in himself. But with the triune God, that really is very different. With this God, we have a God of captivating beauty, who is the truth, the good, and the beautiful. A God of captivating beauty and loveliness. I think the place for us really to start is in God's revelation of himself. And I think particularly of a verse like John 20, verse 31. John 20, verse 31. John writes that he's written his gospel, he's written these things that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, that means the Spirit anointed one, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Now that simple call to faith in Jesus is a call to a belief in a triune God. Jesus, the Spirit anointed one, the Son of God. So what sort of God does Jesus reveal? Well, he is the Son of God. And the God he reveals, and this you see so repeatedly in John's Gospel, the God that the Son reveals is a Father. He is the Son sent from his Father. So he says, John 14:6, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And it's a Father, an eternal Father that he reveals, one who has always been his Father. Now, I think that's something for us that's very easy for us to coast over, because names don't register with us as significant in our culture today. So I was introduced to you as Michael, but I could have been introduced to you as Ulrich, and it would just make no difference to you whatsoever. I could have been introduced as Joan. That would have been slightly surprising. But really, my name means nothing to you. It makes no difference whatsoever. And so we can treat divine names like that, but we really shouldn't. When we speak of God as Father, it's a meaningful name. He is a Father, and a Father is one who begets, one who has a child, one who gives life, one who loves. You're a defective, deficient father if you don't love, but you cannot even be a father if you do not beget a child, if you do not give life. Now, that insight is revolutionary in all our understandings of who God might be. That if God, the God revealed in Jesus, is before all things a Father, before all things, he's life-giving, loving, in and of himself, eternally an outgoing, life-giving God. For eternity, loving, life-giving. And I think this is the sort of thing that John pulls out in 1 John 4. And it'd be worth flicking to see. 1 John 4. We'll go from verse 7. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God. Extremely provocative words. Whoever does not love simply does not know God. I think an illustration would be, if you think of someone in your local church, a senior member of your congregation, someone who's been walking with the Lord for decades and seems to exude godliness. Can you picture the sort of person? Someone who has been walking with Christ for so long, they seem to shine with generosity and kindness and love. And when you go over for Sunday lunch with them, it's really hard to be vicious and catty about people behind their back in that person's presence. You know what I mean? You'll do it an hour later with your friends later. But in their presence, momentarily at least, you're made more loving. Their presence changes you. They are being, in their own small way, images of God, who is love in such a profound and potent way, you cannot even know him without yourself being transformed to become like him, to become loving. And this is very much what it is to be Father, because do you see how John goes on? He writes at the end of the verse, whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. Now, who precisely is he talking about here? The end of verse 8. If you read on to verse 9, you see, this is how God showed his love among us. He sent his only begotten Son. So he's speaking specifically of the Father. This is unpacking his fatherly identity. To be Father means to love, to give out life, to beget the Son. He could not not love and be Father. Before anything else, before eternity, he's loving, giving life to, delighting in his Son, which is why a number of theologians, at which point half of you wake up and half of you go to sleep, a number of theologians, I think of people like Athanasius, John Owen, have loved to focus on fountain language when speaking about the Father. And the imagery they're picking up there is that just as a fountain of water, to be a fountain, it has to pour forth water, the Father, to be a Father, has to pour out love and life. John Owen puts it like this. He says, Jesus Christ is the beam, the stream. Yet by him we are led to the fountain, to the Son of eternal love itself, the free fountain in the bosom of the Father, eternally characterized by pouring out love on his Son by the Spirit. Now, only of this God could you say God is love. That's in his eternal identity. If you were not trying, you could not say that. Only if this God is God can you say that love really is at the center of reality. And your understanding of who God is really going to determine what all reality looks like. What is at the center of reality? Simply raw power? Is it the center of reality? Is it chaos, meaninglessness? Or is there love at the center of reality? Or is love just a side dish, an optional extra? Not central at all. And what we see with this God is that this God's innermost being is an outgoing, loving, life-giving being. So the triune God is an ecstatic God. The word ecstasy is being outside yourself, beside yourself with joy or rage. And this God is an ecstatic God, going outside of himself. That's who he is. And he would demonstrate that in the supreme moment of self-revelation on the cross, giving himself away. So the Father finds his very identity in sharing his life with his Son, giving his life and being to the Son, and the Son images his Father in sharing his life with us through the Spirit. Which means that the nature of this God is at absolute odds with the nature of other gods. Absolute odds, because this God is triune. If this God were a single person, entirely monadic being, his very nature would be entirely different. And we were told by Alex about the Screwtape letters. Let me read you a little bit from the Screwtape letters. C.S. Lewis, he's summing up the difference between the devil, who is a solitary being, and the living God of ecstatic, self-giving, overflowing love. And the reason it's so important to see that the devil is solitary is that any entirely, absolutely singular, monadic God cannot be eternally defined by love. Right? Just as the Father is defined by his relationship with the Son and the Spirit, an entirely monadic being cannot be, and so cannot be defined by love. So Screwtape, a senior demon, writes to Wormwood, a junior demon. He writes, one must face the fact that all gods talk about his love for men, about his service being perfect freedom, is not, as one would gladly believe, mere propaganda, but an appalling truth. He really does want to fill the universe with a lot of loathsome little replicas of himself. Creatures, you must hear John Cleese reading this at some stage if you can get hold of it. creatures whose life on its miniature scale will be qualitatively like his own, not because he's absorbed them, but because their wills freely conform to his. I don't want to strengthen that language a bit, but... We, says Screwtape, we want cattle who can finally become food. He wants servants who can finally become sons. We want to suck in. He wants to give out. We are empty and would be filled. He is full and flows over. A wonderful encapsulation of the difference between the living God and idols. Needy, empty, lacking, desperate for service, sustenance, worship, and in need of nothing, overflowing with life. So full. And one way in which you can get to see the beauty of this God, the beauty of his nature, is through the significance of music. Now, Christianity has always had a special relationship with music, and you can see that through every part of the church. The scriptures are shot through with music, church life is shot through with music. And let me read you something from John Dryden, who's a rather interesting character from the 17th century. John Dryden, he wrote a song for, or an ode for, St. Cecilia's Day, which is the 22nd of November. St. Cecilia was supposed to be the patron saint of church music. Apparently she invented the organ. Anyway, so St. Cecilia's Day is a day where you celebrate the beauty of music. Here's Dryden's ode for St. Cecilia's Day. From harmony, from heavenly harmony, this universal frame began. When nature underneath a heap of jarring atoms lay and could not heave her head, the tuneful voice was heard on high, "Arise, ye more than dead." And then cold and hot and moist and dry in order to their stations leap and music's power obey. From harmony, from heavenly harmony, this universal frame began. From harmony to harmony. Through all the compass of the notes it ran, the diapason, old word for octave, closing full in man. Dryden's words, you have echoes of them in Narnia, Aslan singing Narnia into existence. There's a musical creation. His friend Tolkien does something very similar. There's a musical creation event in the Silmarillion, which not so many people go to, but it's worth going to for that, if nothing else. And in the 18th century, George Frideric Handel put Dryden's words to music, and it is an unmissable listen. If you can find Handel's version of the Ode for St. Cecilia's Day, you get to hear melodically how there's this wonderful moment where there's this musical void, as in Genesis 1, this emptiness, this nothingness. And into that moment bursts this heavenly harmony. From harmony, from heavenly harmony to harmony. The heavenly harmony of Father, Son, and Spirit being the logic behind all harmony. For it is from the heavenly harmony of Father, Son, and Spirit that the universal frame of the cosmos and all created harmony comes. Now, my wife is Welsh, and so there are a lot of harmonies in our family. It seems to come naturally with that Celtic blood. I'm all Anglo-Saxon, and it doesn't come naturally to me, but I can hear the beauty of it, and to hear singing in harmony with people who can do it is really, I find, one of the most ravishing experiences, to hear voices tunefully harmonize with each other and create greater beauty than the sum of the parts. And no wonder, as in heaven, so on earth, the Father, Son, and Spirit have always been in a delicious harmony. And so a world where harmonies, distinct beings, persons, or notes, work in harmony is good, mirroring the very being of the triune God. The eternal harmony of Father, Son, and Spirit provides the logic for all that. It is the music behind all music. And provides the logic for a world which was created to consist in a cheerful conviviality, a working together, and which, despite sin and evil, still displays so much that's essentially harmonious. I think of a Christian musician like Johann Sebastian Bach, who was very theologically thoughtful in his music. And Bach believed that the job of a faithful human musician was to echo forth the work of the divine musician. He believed that on earth, the human musician could sound out the cosmic harmony, the major, the minor keys, the shadows, the lights, the music, the orderliness of it all, echoing out the great symphony of the cosmos. And in that, Bach saw, and this is important for us in understanding who God is and what we can enjoy in a triune God, that what Bach picks up is he produces a music that is not only intellectually deeply satisfying, but very affecting as well. For he's seeing that what he's copying out in music here on earth reflects not only a truth, but a beauty, something for mind and heart to enjoy in our God. Now, Bach's young contemporary, Jonathan Edwards, the great British theologian from the colonies. Jonathan Edwards, he was a great lover of music. That took a while. Jonathan Edwards, one of his favorite words, if you go through his works, was the word harmony. And he declared that the Father, Son, and Spirit constitute the supreme harmony of all. The supreme, the ultimate harmony. And he believed that, like Bach, if we sing together in harmony, as he loved to do with his large family, that we do something that reflects God's own beauty. He says, the best, most beautiful, most perfect, that beauty is important, most perfect way that we have of expressing a sweet concord of mind to each other is by music. When, Edward says, I would form in my mind an idea of a society in the highest degree happy, I think of them as expressing their love, joy, and the inward concord and harmony and spiritual beauty of their souls by sweetly singing to each other. That sweet singing reflects something beautiful about their own harmony and about the very grain of creation because of who the Creator is. There is the deepest, most alluring beauty to be found in the heavenly harmony of the Trinity. The 20th century Swiss theologian Karl Barth said, the triunity of God is the source, the secret of his beauty. It's a very strong statement. The triunity of God is the secret of his beauty. For in the lively harmony of the three persons, that radiant love, the overflowing goodness of this God, there is a beauty that's entirely in a league of its own against the self-serving monotony of all monadic gods, as Screwtape described. And because this God has poured out his life and love, I think we can extend Bart to say the triunity of God is the secret, the source of all beauty. So with the triune God, we have a beautiful God, a God who is the uttermost truth, the uttermost goodness, and the uttermost beauty. A second reason I want to give you why the Trinity is the secret to joyful Christianity is with the triune God, we have a far superior, far sweeter salvation than we could ever have with any other God. Not only a more beautiful God, a sweeter salvation with this God. Here's the thing. With any God you have, the nature of that God will affect the shape of the salvation that God will offer. The character of any God you have will shape what sort of salvation, if any, that God will be prepared to offer. As you've got to think through as a Christian, how does the triune nature of God shape what sort of salvation he offers? It does in every way. Let's imagine if God were entirely monadic, a single person God. If he'd never known fellowship, never known eternal love. If he simply decided to create in order to have a creation to rule over, perhaps to have some slaves, perhaps to get some worship that he was lacking, then salvation would simply be to become his slaves. Salvation would simply be living under his rule. But if God is a Father, Son, and Spirit, a Father loving his Son by his Spirit, the gospel becomes something that will revolutionize every day of those who believe it. For salvation with this God is about becoming Spirit-anointed sons of God. More than just forgiven, certainly more than acceptable slaves, more even than righteous, adopted children of God. For the story of the triune God's salvation is one where the eternal Son comes, stoops down, think Philippians 2, to share with us the life and love that the Father has always eternally lavished on him. He comes to share with us and bring us into the life that is his, that we might be brought before the Most High as children, sharing by the Spirit that's poured out on him, his own Son's Abba cry. What he's always enjoyed, we might come to enjoy. Far superior than simply any blessing flicked out by a distant potentate. And you think of how John's gospel is shot through with this, of the Father's love now encompassing us in Christ. Come with me to John 1. Let's have a look at it together. John 1. Now, if you look at John 1, see, now, the Word comes to us from God, becomes flesh. He's light spoken into darkness, a la Genesis 1. His light drives away the darkness, but what salvation does he bring? Well, verse 12, to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to be children of God. So the Word, the Son, is presented to us as being, verse 18, at being eternally with. There's an extraordinary closeness in the language being used there. It was once translated as being in the bosom of the Father. The Word or Son has been eternally in the bosom of the Father. And Jesus, through John's gospel, declares that his desire is that believers might be with him there. in the bosom of the Father. Now, this is something that gets modelled for us at the Last Supper. The Last Supper, John 13, verse 23. John, one of Jesus' disciples whom Jesus loved was, the English versions usually read something like, was reclining at the table close to Jesus. But actually it's the same language used as back in verse 1, as the word was in the bosom of the Father. So this disciple is said to be in the bosom of the Son. As the word has been eternally in the bosom of the Father, he's brought his friends to be in his bosom, and so where he belongs before the Father. It's why Jesus can say to the Father in John 17, 23, Father, you have loved them even as you have loved me. For he shares with us that intimate Abba cry and status, gives us his own comforter, the Spirit, to be our comforter as well. He shares with us all that he has. The Son comes to us to share his sonship, that we might come back before the Most High in him, sharing all that he has. Now, if God was not a father, he simply could not give us that salvation. He could not give us the right to be children. If he didn't have eternal fellowship with the Son, then almost suddenly he wouldn't really know what fellowship looked like. He wouldn't really have any to share with us. That's certainly what you get to see in other monadic religions. Monadic gods don't have a real fellowship that they can share. And this was a point that Athanasius made against Arius, that if the Son was simply a creature, however exalted, if he'd not himself been eternally in the bosom of the Father, then he himself did not have any fellowship with God that he could share with us. Only if God is Father, Son, and Spirit does he have a fellowship, a closeness he can offer to us. If God was a single person, if God had no Son, salvation would look entirely different. He could allow us to live under his rule and protection. He might be able to offer forgiveness, perhaps. He could not offer sonship, that closeness, that security, that intimacy. And since, by definition, he would not be eternally loving, you have to ask whether he would be able to find it within himself to offer that salvation for free. It's where I would suggest salvation by grace alone flows out of the very being of God. If God were not triune, he would not save by grace. If God were not triune, we wouldn't hear those words of John 17, 23, Father, you've loved them even as you've loved me. We'd have a pseudo-Islamic salvation, created to be slaves, saved to be slaves. But the gospel of this God gives us such an intimacy and confidence before him to be the beloved children of the Most High. Now, no other God could bring us so close and so win our hearts. Not only is he beautiful, he acts beautifully towards us, which changes. Now, here's where it really does change our everyday life. It changes our prayer life. Old John Calvin used to say that Christians pray, as it were, through the mouth of Jesus, knowing the Son's own access to the Father. When I pray as an adopted son of God, I don't pray as a duty to a distant potentate, trying to impress him. I enjoy the privilege of knowing the Most High, of knowing the Omnipotent as my Father. And so I delight to run to him to unburden myself on him, because he's become my Father. And so prayer becomes an inviting thing, a delightful privilege. And particularly, this is poignant in the struggles that we'll read about people having just from today. This affects God's providence and changes, therefore, how you think about facing suffering and uncertainty in life. That the children of God do not have an uncaring monarch in the sky. They can know the loving and tender and ongoing protection of their heavenly kind Father. This was something that John Calvin was wonderful at explaining in his Institutes when he talks about God's providence. And he explains that you don't really understand God's providential rule if you don't understand it as a fatherly care for his creation. Then you'll love it when you see his fatherly care. Well, let me give an example of how that changes a life to know God as being so fatherly. Move from John Calvin to Martin Luther. Martin Luther, the fatherhood of God changed him profoundly. This isn't often related in the story of the Reformation, but it was important for him, and it comes out in his writings. The fatherhood of God was very important for him. Now, as a monk, Martin Luther's mind had been filled with the knowledge that God is righteous. And God is righteous meant for him little more than God will judge unrighteousness. So God's righteousness was a purely terrifying thing to him. He didn't see further into why God hates evil, why he hates sin. And this is key for us. If we think that God is merely the biggest boy in the playground who can throw his weight around, who simply has more power than anyone else, and that's the definition of who God is. If God is just a cosmic boss with no concern or care for those he employs, then you will struggle to have any love for him. This was Luther's experience. He said, with this understanding of God, I did not love, yes, I hated the righteous God who punishes sinners. And secretly, if not blasphemously, certainly murmuring greatly, I was angry with God. Not knowing God as a kind and willing Father, that was bound up with the justification issue for him. A God who brings us close, Luther found he could not love God. Now, everyone's going to love someone or something. And Martin Luther was, of course, no exception. So Luther found he must love someone. He directs his affections to Mary, to the saints. You see this often in Roman Catholicism, a deep, deep affection for Mary because she seems to care. And if God doesn't care, well, you'll love Mary more than God. That changed when he began to see that God is a fatherly God who shares his righteousness, his glory, his wisdom. And when he looked back later on in his life, he reflected that as a monk, he said he had not actually been worshipping the right God. Very strong language he uses. For he said, it is not enough to know God as the creator and judge. Only when God is known as a loving Father is he known aright. For although the whole world has most carefully sought to understand the nature, mind, and activity of God, it's had no success in this whatsoever. Luther always speaks his mind. But God has revealed and disclosed the deepest profundity of his fatherly heart, his sheer inexpressible love, through sending his Son to bring us back to himself. God has revealed himself to be supremely fatherly. And what Luther found is that not only does that bring great assurance and joy, it changed the object of his love and worship. For he saw that here in God is one who is a better parent than Mary, one more compassionate and kind than any other, which wins our hearts to him. And he said, "For we may look through Jesus, we may look into God's fatherly heart and sense how boundlessly he loves us. That would warm our hearts, setting them aglow with thankfulness. In the salvation of this God, then, we see a God we can really love. He is beautiful, and his salvation is beautiful." And seeing that salvation is about being brought to love God says so much about the nature of this God. With this God of eternal relationship, of eternal mutual delight, Christianity is meant to be joyful. "Rejoice always," I say it again, "rejoice," says Paul. "In all things, rejoice." Because with this God, a God where the Father, the Son, and Spirit have been eternally delighting in, finding joy in each other, this God is about more than simply offering us some package of salvation like getting heaven. The Spirit is about drawing us in to that divine life. The Father's eternally delighted in the Son through the Spirit, and the Son in the Father. The Spirit's work, primarily, is in giving us that life as our new life, which is then nothing less than bringing us to share the Father and the Son's mutual delight in the Spirit. That's the new life of the Christian. So the Spirit first opened my eyes and so won my heart by revealing Christ to me. And at that moment, I began to enjoy Christ as I'd never done before. And I began to love Christ as the Father had always done. At that moment, I was starting to become godly, like him in loving the Son. And this is the Spirit's ongoing work as well, that the Spirit stirs me ongoingly, opens my eyes to see Christ that I might grow to love him more, just as the Father does, to an ever deeper, more sincere love for God. And so through the giving of the Spirit, God catches us up into the life, his eternal life of joy, freedom, of a self-forgetfulness and love. The Father's eternally known and loved his great Son, and through the Spirit he opens our eyes and wins our hearts that we might enjoy what the Father's always enjoyed, the Son. And so what's going on then in our salvation is that as we are one to start loving Christ, that love for Christ is an echo, an extension, a spreading out of the Father's own love for Christ. The Father's always enjoyed his Son, and that love is spread and shared with others. And so the Father's love for the Son embraces us, and we share the Father's love for the Son too. In other words, through the Spirit, the Father allows us to share what most delights him, knowing his Son. And that really is the heartbeat of the Christian life, of what it is to be like this God, which is why Jesus says in John 8, if God were your Father, you would love me. For the Father's very identity consists in his love for the Son. And so when we love the Son, we reflect something very characteristic about the Father. And that's the prime reason the Spirit is given. I mentioned John Owen earlier, Puritan theologian. John Owen wrote, therein lies the principal part of our renovation into God's image. Nothing renders us so like unto God as our love unto Jesus Christ. Nothing renders us so like unto God as our love unto Jesus Christ. That's the essence of God-likeness. For it's the Father's identity. All of this should mean that who could prefer the supposedly cleaner idea of a stripped down God, a single person, a non-triune God? Who could prefer that? It has an immediate cleanness, a logical neatness to it, which has an immediate appeal. But as soon as you press in, you see the illogicality of it and the lack of beauty there, a monotony, unlike the beautiful harmony you see in the triune God. You strip down God and you strip out the beauty of who he is and what his salvation is. And instead of a life bursting with love, joy, fellowship, you're left with, well, a distant potentate instead of a loving father. Instead of fellowship, contract. No security in the beloved son. No heart change to be brought to love him as the Father does. No joy in God. So far from being a theological annoyance, far from being a wart on our knowledge of God, the fact that God is Father, Son, and Spirit is just what makes the Christian life beautiful. And a question I'd add at the end is, would not people rail less, fight less at the existence of God if they heard clearly that we believe in this God? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. Obviously, you got some spontaneous applause there. And I'm sure that in addition to clapping, we'd like to ask you some questions and make some comments. So it's now over to you. Who would like to start off? Yes.
I was thinking. Sorry.
Well, you come first? Yes.
I was thinking of.
You speak out so that.
Yes. Manifestations of God in the Old Testament, where, for example, I tend to think of when Daniel was in the lion's den, for example. The other person. Does that fit in with the Trinity, or when the angel of
Testament, do they flow out from this, the fact that God is triune, for example, particularly the appearance of one like a son of the gods or the son of God in Daniel 6 or the angel of the Lord? Yes, absolutely. I think there's an interesting verse we almost hit, John 1:18. John writes at the beginning of his gospel that no one has ever seen God. Any Jew reading that would say, well, that's absolute rubbish. Lots of people have seen God. But he goes on, but God the only begotten, or God the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. So who do you think you have seen? The Word, the one who always makes his Father known. So you've not seen the Father. So there are some ideas, for instance, that the three figures who appear in Genesis 18 to Abraham There's some confusion on this, but some people are prepared to take that as an appearance of the three persons of the Trinity. I think John 1:18 would say that's not possible. That can't be an appearance because no one has ever seen the Father. So it's not the Father appearing. But you do have people meeting one who's sent from the Lord, one who calls himself Almighty Lord, yet who's sent from the Lord. Absolutely. But because Trinity is not something that's starting in the New Testament, you have a triune God before creation. And that's absolutely critical to understand for the nature of God. That if God becomes triune, if at some point the Father decides to have a son, then he's not eternally loving. He's chosen at some point to love. There was an interesting, sorry, I'm waffling my answer, but there's an interesting study on the theology of Arius done. Arius claimed that the Son was a created being. And there was a study done back in the 1980s which linked that teaching to the idea of salvation by works by saying that if God has simply chosen to have a son at some point, choice dictates everything. It's not actually about the Father having eternally loved his son, and therefore that works in our salvation too. We can simply choose to respond to God. It's not that our hearts are one to love him. Yeah. One more at the back.
There's a word that you used, not being a theologian, I don't know if I quite heard it. Was it monadic?
Yes.
Is that how do you spell that?
A monad, M-O-N-A-D. And what I'm trying to get across with a word like monad, I sort of translated it with the phrase a single person God. But what I'm trying to get at with the word monad is, for example, an Islamic concept of God. In Islam, Allah is defined by oneness, an absolute categorical, no messing around in any sense, oneness. And that's not what Christians believe in. We believe that the Lord our God, the Lord is one, but in a different sense to Muslims would say it. Yeah. Is that okay?
Mike, I greatly appreciated your description of the beauty and of the harmony of God. Sometimes when we explain the atonement, we're not very good at keeping that in the framework of the beauty and the harmony of God. Can you help us on that a bit, please?
Yes, there's a lot to be said there. Were God not triune, if the Father did not have a Son, the cross would do us no good. So we need triune God for the atonement to work. The reason is this. If God himself could not provide the substitute, we would have to provide the substitute ourselves. And that would be neither grace nor possible. Because if we're simply having to provide one of us as the substitute, it's not that God himself takes human nature and himself provides, then we have to provide the substitute, so it's not salvation by grace, and we have to provide a perfect substitute, which isn't possible. But with a triune God, you see, this God deals with the problem of his wrath at evil within himself such that he can offer salvation entirely for free. He's accomplished everything himself. The other part of it that you may be hinting at, that people sometimes get confused on, is I often have people asking me things like, was the Trinity falling apart at the cross? When the Son cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is this the Trinity being ripped apart? And I've heard preachers say things like, the cross is the moment when God is being ripped apart, almost like what you see happening to Jesus' body being an image of what's happening to the Trinity. I've also heard the reason that the Son is darkened is because the cosmos is now in meltdown, because the God is being ripped apart. I think that's quite a misunderstanding of the relationship between the Father and the Son, that the Father eternally loves the Son, and he does not stop loving the Son, even at the cross. He's pleased with his Son as his Son gives his life away. Jesus even says, for this reason my Father loves me, that I lay down my life. His Father is pleased with this, but he's also pouring out his anger judicially on his Son as our substitute. And the reason those two don't kick against each other is because God's wrath is not something alien to and unreconcilable with his love. And I think we can talk that language too easily to say that God on Monday is loving and on Tuesday is wrathful. And when he's feeling loving, he can't feel angry, because that's what I'm like, right? When I'm feeling loving, I don't feel angry. That's not how it is with God. The God of eternal love, the Father's always enjoyed loving his Son, finds that wrath is how he responds, how the ever-loving God responds to evil. And it's not that he's switching off his love, it's how his love hits up against evil. And so when he expresses his wrath, he's not switching off his love. It's how it's his love is expressing itself. Yeah.
Any more? I'd like to mention something else about the harmony and in relation to worship. You mentioned Bach and Handel and the harmony. Probably most contemporary worship does not major on harmony in the same way. Do you think that's a lacking, and do you think it's something we can learn from? I don't mean we should junk all contemporary worship, but you know, should we build in more of that if it was such a kind of pointer to God for Bach and Handel?
That's very interesting. If I can start getting a little more speculative here, if you look at the history of music in the West, is where I know music. So I don't really know Indonesian music, I'm afraid, so I'll just look at the West. In the West, where music is strongest that we know of, in the monasteries in the early High Middle Ages, the sort of music that they have is, think of Gregorian chant. And it's very purposeful how the singing is done. Now, it starts changing at the time of the Renaissance. But before the Renaissance, at the High Middle Ages and Early Middle Ages, Gregorian chants are every voice is the same. Nobody stands out. There's also no beat to it. And that's a deliberate thing, because you don't want the monks starting to... Exactly, because if they start moving their bodies, they'll be aware that their bodies and all sorts of chaos will happen. And you don't want that. So there's no beat deliberately, because beat is a very physical thing. And there's no harmony, no solos. The solos start creeping in at the Renaissance, interestingly. But from there, you just get to see that clearly there are agendas, pastoral and theological agendas, in how the music is structured and sung. And that does change at the Reformation. You have a much greater variety of music comes in. So I think, yes, that does reflect something that's good and right about who God is. I don't think that's particularly intentional. I don't think it's theologically joined up. But yes, I think for today, it's a good thing. If you have no singing in church, I think that does reflect something theological. If you have simply all monotone, that says something as well. Yeah.
I was interested in your comment on us backing off on the Trinity for missional purposes. Do you get any remedies for that?
Yeah. My own experience in speaking with Muslims, for example, has been that shop fronting the Trinity has been hugely productive. Now, there are some people who'd say, no, in speaking with Muslims, talk about the commonalities we have. And there is a right place for that. There's absolutely a right place for that. So when I speak with Muslims, I want to very quickly emphasize that we're people of the book, of scripture. And actually, one of the reasons is that I will go in on Trinity quite quickly with a Muslim. And usually Muslims are keen to do that because they think that's my weak point. So they're thinking, here's the illogicality in his system. Let's press on that. And they'll have all sorts of verses that, for example, Deuteronomy 6, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Aha, so it can't be Trinity. They'll fire verses to be anti-Trinitarian. But actually, their main anti-Trinitarian arguments tend to be philosophical, not scriptural. And so a challenge I often put back is, we are people of the book, you are to be scriptural in your arguments, not simply philosophical. So the sort of argument I've had put to me is, if God is three persons, the cosmos simply wouldn't be orderly because you'd have three competing wills. That's a terrible understanding of the Trinity in any case. But it's a philosophical argument. I want to look at what Scripture's saying. So I think, very simply, I'd say with Muslims, I'd want to talk about the Trinity a bit quicker. I think in evangelizing the average atheist or agnostic on the street, I'd want to as well. I think much of the anti-God heat that we've seen in culture over the last few years has been a kicking against a monadic sort of God. So you look at Christopher Hitchens' heat in God Is Not Great, The Case Against Religion, and his description of God is that he's a big brother. He's a totalitarian despot in the sky. Therefore, you would not want God to exist, would you? Now let me roll out the reasons why God doesn't exist. But if we can say, hang on, let's just change the definition of God. What if God is not a totalitarian despot? What if he is, Christopher Hitchens, the loving father that you always wished you had? Might you not want this God to be true?
Could you expand a little bit on your comments on the Trinity with regard to our sun worship? Mm-hmm. You went as far as the Reformation,
yeah.
But we are now in the 21st century,
yeah.
And our sun worship in across a broad spectrum of our churches, yeah, is very varied. Do you have any comment to make on how best our worship should be from a Trinitarian aspect, perhaps even with regard to contemporary composers?
Do you mean Christian composers?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think the first thing I'd say would be about substance, not style, though I would want to talk about style as well. And I think especially in... I hope this isn't too jaundiced. More modern, slightly more theologically lightweight attempts to be Trinitarian in lyrics tend to be giving lip service to the name. So we'll say Father, Son, and Spirit, and we've done the job. But because the triune being of God shapes everything about who God is and how he works, I'd like to see that shaping the structure of songs and hymns. You do get to see some good examples of that, but to see, for example, that who God is means that salvation is about our adoption as spirit-anointed sons of God. I hope it's okay that I say sons. I say son specifically not as to be gender exclusive, but because the status we're given is precisely the status of the Son. And so I'm happy to talk about children of God. I'm not being misogynist there. But the reason I say sons is I want to emphasize it's not that we're given some vague status of being children. We're given the status of the son. Men have to make peace with being part of the bride of Christ. So we've all got some give and take. So I think some of the substance of the lyrics. But yes, I think I would like to see, not just harmony, but a greater thoughtfulness in how music is done. I see in someone like a Jonathan Edwards or a Bach an extraordinary thoughtfulness on the structure of music and the meaning of that structure. What does major mean? Why are we given major, minor octaves? What do they all mean? And if even those seem to have meaning, and Jonathan Edwards was wild on the details of all this kind of stuff, if even those have meaning, we should be theologically sensitive to how we use them. Yeah, that's...
Thank you very, very much indeed. I studied your book in Edinburgh, but listening to you is even better than that. Could you say perhaps something about the Incarnation and the implications of the Incarnation for how you put the Trinity? Because, for example, you mentioned that we share in the Son's, in the Father's eternal love for the Son. Yeah. But obviously, the Son became man, and as man, he knew as man the Father, and enjoyed him as man. Mm-hmm. So can you just say something about our sharing in his human love of the Father?
Mm, yeah. Sorry, I've not been repeating the questions. I've been asked to talk about the Incarnation and our sharing in the Son's human love for the Father. I think something that's absolutely critical in understanding the Incarnation is that God the Son does not give up who he is. He pours himself out. He empties himself, but he does not empty himself of his godness. It's a pouring out of himself. And so, and if he were emptying himself of his godness, of his sonship, then his incarnation would do us no good, because he wouldn't be bringing us his own sonship to humanity. So it's very important that he remains God the Son incarnate. Then what you get to see with him as a man, I think it's important to see that it's consistent with who he is as the Son. So you see that the Father loves Jesus, and Jesus, filled with the Spirit, loves the Father. I think of it couple of instances of that. John 14:31, I love the Father and do what he commands. And Luke 10, where Jesus said to be filled with the Spirit, filled with joy in the Holy Spirit, and so cries, I praise you, Father. There's a similar dynamic in both things happening. Now, that is the man Jesus being filled with the Spirit, but there isn't a great discrepancy there to the eternal Son. For just as the man is, he knows the love of the Father by the Spirit, he's sent out into the wilderness by the Spirit as a man, he's equipped to do miracles in the power of the Spirit and so on, that actually had been how he was as the Word as well. Is the Spirit who empowers the Word to go out. And you see this in Genesis 1. So what we're seeing in the man Jesus is a revelation of who he is as the Son, and a bringing of that relationship he has to us as man. Yeah. Sorry.
A thousand amens to that. Would you be happy to say, and yeah, I agree completely, would you be happy to say that we haven't emphasized sufficiently in the church our sharing in the human enjoyment and appropriation of God by Jesus? But we can appreciate his divinity, but have we appreciated the significance of his humanity sufficiently?
No. no, I don't think we have appreciated the significance of his humanity. I think when theologians attempt to do it, it's sometimes dangerous. I've seen it go in strange ways at times. But what was held up, for example, Thomas Goodwin's The Heart of Christ is a good example of an appreciation of the humanity of Christ. And what Goodwin does in that is he looks at the pastoral importance of the fact that there is a man on the throne of heaven now. He's really drawing out Hebrews, the end of Hebrews 4, that we do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who's been tempted in every way as we have, yet was without sin. That when we pray, we may know that the one through whom we pray, our high priest, has been tempted in every way, is utterly sympathetic. And so we don't have a distant, unsympathizing God. So that's partially important, the fact that he's a man now. The fact that his humanity is in heaven is also the guarantee of our salvation. And emphasizing his humanity is emphasizing the reality of our salvation. This is salvation brought to being man. And to be saved is never to be less human. Someone who, I think, draws this out beautifully, though it's never quite his point, is Augustine in the Confessions, which is worth a read if no one's read it. Chadwick's translation is the one to get. And Augustine in the Confessions makes it so palpably obvious that becoming a Christian is a process of becoming more human, which is why you can identify with him across 1600 years. He's just so human. He ticks the way you tick. And so you're won by his argument. Let's talk about Augustine for an hour, shall we?
Yeah. Moving on from that, given the fact that Jesus subordinated himself to the Father on earth, do you believe that there was subordination within the Trinity ontologically?
Do I believe there's subordination within the Trinity ontologically? Yes, I do. Yes, I do take that to be the case, that the Son always does the will of the Father. The Son goes at the will of the Father. And this seems to be something within creation itself, within the very act of creation, that the Father is praised as the creator and the Son is the agent of creation doing the will of the Father. That sort of thing, you know, stepping back even before the incarnation, suggests to me that, yes, that there is eternally an ordering of relationship. Now, that said, is an extremely hot question to ask. Of course, you know that. I'm sure you know that. And I have to say, I think people on both sides of the debate might have slightly misspoken in how they talk about this relationship, because they're focusing on subordination in an abstract sense rather than looking at the nature of the father-son relationship. And I'll just chuck in my pennies worth quickly. I take it that if the father-son relationship defines what headship is and what subordination is, then you see it's an entirely loving, positive, good thing and not a negative dominatory thing at all. And I think that hasn't always been said as clearly as it could have been. Do you want to come back on that? We're into red hot territory.
I just don't agree with you, but I'd rather not come back on that.
On that same issue, is there any difference then in your understanding of the relationship between the Father and the Son ontologically and economically? Are you saying that it's exactly the same in both cases?
No, I wouldn't want to say that. No, that's too strong.
So is the subordination different?
I don't think the subordination is different, but I wouldn't want to conflate the two. I don't want to conflate the economic and the ontological. But I don't think the subordination is radically different at all. Yeah.
Do you want to?
No, it's late.
Okay.
it.
So you've been warned that Andrew McGarren will be asking another question tomorrow. So thank you very much indeed. That's been very, very helpful, very stimulating, very challenging, and I'm sure you'd have another